Send a happy birthday shout out to my lovely lady Anne. Happy birthday to you. And that's coming from everyone here at the Positive Vibe Show. And of course, your wonderful brother Carrington, who called in and wanted to big you up. I want to thank everyone for all your wonderful calls. I appreciate you, and I know that you appreciate me. I thank you so, so much. It's Positive Vibes here on CKUT 90.3.
Sister Annie, happy birthday, strong year. We'll see you. See you.
Kissy floating. War in a Babylon. Tribal war in a Babylon. Look at that. Kissy floating. What you say? Kissy floating. Oh yeah. War in a Babylon. Tribal war in a Babylon. Is it out there? What you say? Is it out there? Oh yeah. The Baba men no like the dreadlocks man. The dreadlocks man no like the Baba man. No. The police men no like the dreadlocks man. The dreadlocks man no. Tribal war in a Babylon. Is it out there? Who are you saying? Is it out there? Oh yeah. War in a Babylon. Tribal war in a Babylon. Is it out there? Who are you saying? Is it out there? Oh yeah. When we come right
there is this thing. Do you realize what is there is this thing? Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show, a part of CKUT's Off the Hour. Prison Radio has been on the air for more than 10 years. Prison Radio seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggle by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging our ideas about what are prisons and the people inside our jails. Prison Radio is dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. This is in the interest of forging stronger ties with incarcerated and non-incarcerated people, ensuring that prisoners have direct control over their representation, and that our understanding of prisons be informed by those who live inside their walls. We invite anyone who is interested in collaborating on programming to contact us. Those who have been affected by the prison system in any way are encouraged to get involved. You can email news@cqt.ca or prison@cqt.ca, or you can call us at 514-448-4041, extension 6788. You are listening to CQUT, Montreal Community Campus Radio, located on 90.3 FM on the dial and www.cqut.ca online.
Listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Candace.
My name is Noah.
And we're your hosts for today's show. Today on the Prison Radio Show, we'll be airing part of a panel discussion by the Freedom Archives. The panel was titled Prisoners and Politics from the San Quentin Six to Pelican Bay and featured four different speakers addressing different aspects of historical and contemporary prison resistance. The part of the panel we will be airing features Dan Berger, author of Captive Nation, Black Prison Organizing in the Civil Rights Era. We'll also be airing two short pieces by Asata Shakur. And finally, we'll be joined at the end of the show by a member of the collective Toute Détention et Politique, who will speak to us about an upcoming event they are organizing. But first, we'll start the show off with some news.
New York State Governor Cuomo has just proposed to limit visiting at New York State maximum security prisons to 3 days a week instead of the current seven. If passed, this measure will cause suffering and separation for thousands of imprisoned people and their loved ones. We have the following text from a petition currently circulating to put pressure on Governor Cuomo and other New York State officials to not pass this restriction. Restricting visits is regressive, counterproductive, and cruel. Family visits are often the only ways people in prison can maintain connections with children, spouses, elderly parents, or grandparents, and other family and friends. These ties are crucial for loved ones on the outside as well as for people to survive their incarceration with their health and well-being intact and to successfully navigate their eventual return home after prison. Evidence has long shown that enhancing family and community connections is not only extremely valuable for people incarcerated and their loved ones, but also increases safety in prisons and improves people's success after their release. It is already incredibly difficult for family and friends to visit their loved ones in prison in New York. Governor Cuomo's proposal to limit visiting at maximum security prisons to just the weekends instead of the current policy of visits on any day of the week will restrict both the ability for people to visit and impose unnecessary burdens on weekend visit days. Under the current seven-day system, already visitors often wait 2 to 3 hours to see their loved ones, typically after traveling for hours. With reduced days, the wait will be longer, the visitor rooms more crowded, and the visiting days and hours even more limited. This will be terrible for everyone and impossible for many visitors. While in other contexts, the governor claims to want to support compassionate policies and reduce mass incarceration, his visit reduction proposal will seriously escalate suffering and family disruption, as well as have a negative impact on prison safety and people's successes upon release. Governor Cuomo must withdraw this proposal and instead take steps to further expand access for people to visit their loved ones in prison. Please sign the petition and call Governor Cuomo at 518-474-8390 to insist that the governor retract this proposal. The petition can be found at the website change.org. You can also write to Governor Cuomo opposing the cutback in visiting hours in New York State maximum prisons. You can go to www.governor.ny.gov/content/governor-contact-form. You can also write to Governor Cuomo, Governor Andrew M. Cuomo, New York State Capitol, Albany, New York, zip code 12224.
And No Pride in Prisons is a group based in New Zealand which advocates for incarcerated people and the end of prisons. No Pride in Prisons is currently organizing a campaign called 10,000 Too Many, as the prison population in a particular region in New Zealand, Aotearoa, has reached 10,000 for the first time. The group is planning a protest on February 11th and has issued specific demands. And so from their website, the No Pride in Prisons website, they say, recent ombudsman's reports have revealed that prisoners are exposed to constant threats of violence and subjected to practices that amount to torture. There is no reason to keep locking more people away from their loved ones in inhumane conditions. It doesn't help them become better people, and it doesn't keep their communities safe. The government has continued to ignore the growing evidence that prisons don't do what they're supposed to. Over the next few years, $1 billion worth of prison construction and expansion has been planned, including a new facility at Waikaria Prison that will house 1,500 more prisoners. This year, the New Zealand government budgeted $1 billion for the Department of Corrections. What could $1 billion be doing for impoverished communities across the region, for the 23,000 children with a parent in prison, for education, for housing, for the 1,500 people who are going to be put in the prison? It is clear that at this point, the government cannot justify its commitment to the existing prison system. This is nothing more than incarceration for incarceration's sake, and it is unacceptable. And so demands from the No Pride in Prisons website include, one, the immediate repeal of the Bail Amendment Act 2013. Because since it came into force, this act has put 1,000 more people who have not been found guilty of anything in prison. And two, the immediate end to all planning, development, and construction of the new facility at Waikiara Prison, which will house 1,500 more prisoners. 2017 is an election year in New Zealand, and no matter what happens, it will be a year of political shakeups and new leadership. Urgent action is required now to act and make clear that the enormous human and financial waste that is our prison system is unconscionable and cannot continue. We invite you to come to the march on February 11th in New Zealand with us and help us make it known that we will not accept the government's reckless disregard for people's lives. And so again, the demonstration will be taking place on February 11th in Auckland, New Zealand.
The National Film Board of Canada is pleased to present the award-winning film Angry Inuk, opening on Friday, February 10 at the Cinéma du Parc.
In Angry Inuk, a new generation of Inuits armed with social media and their own sense of humor and justice are challenging anti-sealing groups and bringing their own voices into the conversation.
Filmmaker Alitia Arnakok-Barry joins her other Inuit activists to challenge outdated perceptions of Inuit and present themselves to the world as modern people determined to succeed in the global economy. Produced by Unicat Studio in Iqaluit and the NFB in association with iSteel Films.
Check your local listings for screening times and log on to nfb.ca/angryinuk to share the trailer. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Social Justice Days 2017, February 8th to 14th. Join Kubrick McGill for a series of workshops, discussions, film screenings, and cultural events engaging local and global issues. Events will include workshops on accessibility as collective care, self-care under neoliberal capitalism, suicide intervention for weirdos, freaks, and queers, panels on perspectives on Syria, films envisioning queer, feminist, and anti-racist futures, a Convergence Journal launch, and the Self-Love Cabaret. That's Wednesday, February 8th to February 14th at venues around Montreal. All events are wheelchair accessible and open to the public. More information is available through the Kubrick McGill Facebook page. Social Justice Days 2017, a CKUT co-presentation.
Next here on the Prison Radio Show, we have part of a panel that was recorded by the Freedom Archives in 2015. The panel was titled Prisoners and Politics, from the San Quentin Six to Pelican Bay, and featured four different speakers addressing different aspects of historical and contemporary prison resistance. So the part of the panel we will be airing today features Dan Berger, author of the recently released Captive Nation, Black Prison Organizing in the Civil Rights Era. This clip contains strong language, and it's about 26 minutes long.
I'm introducing Dan Berger, who fortunately is a good friend and somebody that we've worked with for many years. actually spent time in our archive doing research on the book that he will discuss. And so on a personal and a political level both, we have a lot of respect for Dan and his work and are pleased that he can join us tonight. So without further ado...
All right. Thank you all so much for coming tonight. I'm really, really delighted to be here and to see so many of you, several old friends from various moments in life, and also just the chance to support the great work that Chris and Lisa Ruth and the Shaping San Francisco series are doing, as well as to give back in some way to the Freedom Archives, where I spent many, many hours going through books and newspapers and audio that they have from these struggles in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond. A really remarkable resource. And I know a number of you traveled from the East Bay as well, so thank you for making the trek. I want to talk a little bit about my book and connect it to everything that is going on in California in the movements against prisons today, which turns out to be quite a lot. And I'm really honored to share the stage with Bato and David and Caitlin, and to share the audience with Sundi and a number of people who I know have been very frontline involved in these struggles. And of course, the movements of the 60s and 70s and early 80s are with us in so many ways. And I think there are two things that really bring that to bear. Chris already mentioned the settlement in the lawsuit against the state of California for its policies of solitary confinement. I know Caitlin's going to be talking more about that. But of course, we also have the murder of San Quentin Six co-defendant and the only one of the San Quentin Six who is still in prison, Hugo Yogi Pinnell, in mid-August, right? And that this came in the middle of Black August, a sort of prisoner-initiated holiday with such strong connections to the movements of that time period, I think makes the tragedy and the bitterness of his death all the more painful, right? And so there's a lot in the book about sort of trying to unpack, Yogi's place in history. But I think we also need to see, Yogi's incarceration, ongoing incarceration, and death in prison as connected to the expansion of solitary confinement that prisoners in Pelican Bay and elsewhere have struggled over. And I'm going to try and make that clear today, right? Because I think when we talk about mass incarceration, right, which has been getting a lot more attention in recent years, we ought to understand it as an attack on existing social movements and potential social movements, right? The people that go to prison, that are brutalized by the police and find themselves in prison, these were attacks on movements, right, in the 60s, right? Both by criminalizing people for their activism, but also by brutalizing, oppressing, imprisoning people who would be part of those movements, right, if they weren't incarcerated, right? And I think part of what's so important about this time period, right, is that some of the people who struggled with police violence found themselves in places like San Quentin and the adjustment centers, right, the sort of solitary confinement units of the 60s and 70s, saw themselves as part of the movements, right, that participated in, contributed to the movements that were not only happening on the streets, but brought them into prison cells as well, right? And so part of what I'm sort of saying in this book and how I think we ought to sort of, bless you, re-understand the whole time period, right, is that, what we think of as the kind of civil rights and Black Power movements were always in conflict, right, with the state in general, right, but with the carceral state, right, with police, with prisons, right. When we think about the kind of main leaders and spokespeople of that movement, right? These are all people who were incarcerated, right? Some were incarcerated for their activism, right? Rosa Parks, Fannie Lou Hamer, sort of most famously, right? And some became activists because of their imprisonment, right? People like Malcolm X, right, who said, don't be shocked when I say that I was in prison. That's what America means, prison. Right? And that understanding of how deeply connected prisons and racism, right, prisons and violence were, right, animated the whole generation of struggle, right? And that understanding connects elements of the movements that are often separate, right, that often disagreed. So you have, not only sort of, militant revolutionary nationalists like Malcolm X or the Black Panthers, but even Martin Luther King talking about that, the experience of going to prison, making people impatient to be free, right, being a sort of empowering, transformative experience in a larger revolutionary movement. I thought I would read just a quick excerpt of the book to give some example of it, and I was tempted to read something from the California side of it, but you're going to have much more powerful testimonies from Bato and Sundi. So I wanted to read just a short excerpt from the South in Georgia from an activist with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee named Michael Simmons, who was imprisoned for resisting induction into the military and refusing to fight in Vietnam War. So when a guard told Simmons and nine other SNCC members to stop chanting Black Power while they conducted menial labor, Simmons told him off. The guard then pulled out his gun. "You motherfucker," Simmons responded. "What are you going to do, shoot us?" Simmons walked toward the armed guard, holding the pick with which he had been splitting rocks. "You got 6 bullets," he told the guard. "There are 10 of us. 4 of us are going to kill you." Simmons told him to put the gun away. "And I just kept walking towards him. Man, he put it away." Simmons acknowledges that his action was pure bluster. All he had to do was shoot one shot in the air and say, "Well, goddammit, it won't be your ass killing me," and I would have shit all over myself, Simmons concedes. But the guard balked at this unexpected display of strength. Right? That those kinds of stories and episodes, which again, many people here could, and I'm sure will, have their own examples of, really characterize this time period, right? Where prisons were sort of central to the understanding of what it meant to be an activist, right? To be on the left in some ways, right? And it's great that mass incarceration has been getting so much attention in the last few years, right? But it took, the prison population topping 2.3 million, police and surveillance and carceral technologies working their way into every aspect of our lives before it really garnered that kind of popular appeal. What was so stunning to me about this time period, right, is that this is a moment when the prison population is 200,000 people, right? A fraction of what it is today. And yet you had examples like that, right? You had people recognizing how central prisons were to their everyday ideology, right? In organizations like the Black Panthers, right? In the somewhat spontaneous or sort of ad hoc occupation of Alcatraz Island by diverse groups of indigenous activists that lasted for 2 years. In cases like Los Siete de la Raza, right, a very important case within the Chicano movement within the Bay Area in the late 60s, 1970, and within the anti-war movement as well. Right? Now, the fact that so many groups sort of recognized how important prisons were appropriately, understandably, led to a greater focus on people in prison themselves, right? Especially as people like some of the people here with us tonight, right, organize their own protests and strikes and demonstrations, right? So this is a picture of a demonstration in support of the Soledad brothers, right? Three prisoners who were charged with the death of a guard in 1970, the most famous of which was George Jackson, who I'm sure is a familiar name to many of you, right? The other two men, Fleeta Drumgo, became a co-defendant in the San Quentin Six, and the third, John Clouchet, is still in prison today. Right? He was released for a few years, and around 1976, and has been in prison since 1980, right? And was recently denied parole, or his parole was granted and then overturned, right? And they talked about his connection to the Soledad brothers, right? And his connection to the San Quentin Six as a reason for overturning his parole, right? So much of the sort of prison movement at that time gave us an intellectual culture that lasts, right? Biographies and books by people like Malcolm X and George Jackson, Angela Davis, but also newspapers, right? Arm the Spirit is a really powerful newspaper that was published for several years, edited by people on the inside in San Quentin, and distributed by people on the outside in the Bay Area, right? Now, the Freedom Archives has a nearly complete collection of the newspaper, right? So I talked a little bit about George Jackson, right, who was a central figure in the prison movement, not only in California, but really inspirational, influential to people all over the world, right? Michael Simmons, who I read the story about, talked about learning about the Holocaust for the first time from seeing George Jackson sign his letters from Dachau with love, right? And that that connection of sites of confinement, detention, and murder, right, being very educational, right, a sort of global education at that time period. And his death in 1971 by the hands of prison guards had rippled in a number of ways, right? One of those people here probably are familiar with the Attica Rebellion, right, one of the largest prison riots of the time period, started in part in response by prisoners having a silent protest in honor of George Jackson, right? Because it was other people in prison who were most inspired by George Jackson, right? That understanding that despite confinement, despite everything that came with imprisonment, someone could still have the fortitude to write about it and to be as honest as he tried to be, right, about that experience, was tremendously inspirational for people in prison in particular, which is why so many people in California have been sent to solitary or kept in solitary for having books by George Jackson, right, that remained an offense that could send you to solitary confinement, and perhaps that's now since changed, right? But I want to talk a little bit about the San Quentin Six case, in part because I think it's a really important example of what can happen in prison, right? And in part maybe to provide a little background to the comments that David and Bato will make. But also I think it has really important parallels and kind of precedents to what we've seen in Pelican Bay and prisons across the country. Right, so when George Jackson was killed on August 21st, 1971, five other people were killed that day in a takeover of the solitary confinement unit, three guards and two other prisoners, right? And I still have chills hearing Sundi and Bato and David talk about the response, right? Talk about what guards did to them and to the other people on the yard that day. And you can read about that in the book, and if you'd like, right? There were 20 other people in the tier, right? And after that, there was an effort to charge them, right? Try to find who did it, and six people were selected by the state, right, to stand trial for the violence that occurred that day, and the state had been painting this as a race riot. Right, and this is the language of California prisons to this day. Right, Jeffrey Beard responding to the hunger strike as a gang power play. Right, of these, you know, tribal battles. Right, of sort of race war in prison. Right, and you know, the prisoners today put out the agreement to end hostilities. Well, in to challenge that idea that this was a kind of race war, right? And the San Quentin Six did a version of that in their way, right? The fact that it was four black men and two Latino men offered already a sort of multiracial challenge, right? That the issue is not people fighting each other. The problem was one of state violence, right? The problem was the prisons, right? And the kind of solidarity that they were able to express with each other across that sort of rippled across other social movements and the campaigns around them. Right, is one thing that I want to highlight. The other thing is the intensity surrounding their case. Right, so you can see here, or I hope you can see here, how intensely shackled they all are. Right, hands to waist to feet. Right, feet together. And you can see all three of them. Right, this is in the courtroom. Right. In addition to being shackled, you see this big plexiglass barrier, right, sort of trying to separate the defendants from people that came to express their support and solidarity with the trial, right? Part of the effort, part of what prisons do, right, is to sort of tear apart families and communities and various forms of collectivity, right? And this case sort of extended that further, right? Wanting to keep people in prison at a distance, even in one of the rare spaces when they can be sort of accessible to public, right? And so this case was a kind of turning point in which the state was, I think, experimenting with different forms of kind of extra isolation, right? They were all held in solitary confinement through the length of the trial, right? And Bato, in particular, shared with me some sort of darkly humorous stories of the routine tear gassings and beatings that would accompany, right? So when we think about mass incarceration, it's not simply about the number of people in prison, right? But it's the severity and harshness of it, right? And the response to the killing of George Jackson that we see through not only the trial of the San Quentin Six, but the treatment, right? I think testifies to some of that, right? That this was experiments in isolation, right? Experiments in more punitive, more harsh, more violent conditions in response to prisoner organizing, activism, and so on, right? Now, there was various kind of support demonstrations and activities that sustained on the outside over 5 years, right? At the time when it finally was settled, the San Quentin Six case was the longest trial in California history. And I think those sorts of, taking that amount of time, right, it is in part a way to kind of bleed off that support, right? It's hard to sort of sustain people's energy and attention over the same kind of case, right, when people aren't accessible and available for that many years. So I wanted to provide some documentation of it, as well as the wonderful 1970s-ness of it all, right? And the last picture that I'll show of it, something that David sent me when I was finishing the book, and this picture to me is perfect, right? It's what I wanted to be the cover of the book, because I think it gets at what prison organizing means or looks like. Right? Prisons obviously are restrictive, isolated places that don't have public access. It's really almost impossible to get a organic picture of what happens inside, right? A literal picture, or even a figurative picture, right? We have pictures of visits, right? But to see something that's happening in an unstaged way at all is rare in prison. But also to see something politically, right, in prison, right, an example of a protest, right, the kind of thing that happens, that certainly happened with some regularity, but it's so hard to actually visualize. And part of what I love about this picture, right, is when people, to the extent that people hear or think about, you know, prison protests, right, we have images of riots and violence and you know, these sort of dramatic disturbances, right? And what we have here is a sit-in, right? David and Yogi and Flita were sort of being walked through the yard when there happened to be a tour through the prison, right, as a part of their lawsuit against the prison, happening simultaneously to the charges, criminal charges against them, right? And there was a photographer present, and they were sort of protesting, sort of being on display in that way, right? And how do you protest in that moment, right? Surrounded by, I don't know, 7 or 8 guards, right? When 3 people shackled, there's a sit down, right? And I think that example of creativity, of resiliency, and of a certain kind of quiet militancy that I think is one that sort of characterizes organizing in prison and organizing in any space or example, right, where people face tremendous obstacles, right, tremendous barriers to their very humanity, right, and yet so much of the organizing then, as well as the organizing that we see around the hunger strikes and so on more recently, is, I think, a remarkable affirmation of people's creativity and sort of existence as social beings, right? That translated some on the outside, right? This is a picture after they were all released or acquitted, right? And you see David and Bato and Sundi with Inez Garcia, right? A woman who was charged with killing a man who had sexually abused her, right? Who had raped her. And I think that coming together, right, sort of part of what prison being a sort of central understanding to social movements at that time, right, is that it could be a space where social movements could come together, right, where feminist movements and anti-violence movements could come together with not only Black liberation movements and others in a kind of larger anti-prison agenda, right, politics. Right, which I think we could sort of think about as a larger movement in pursuit of freedom from violence. Right, so let me just wrap up with a couple of things here. Mass incarceration, right, we've seen the number of people in prison skyrocket by, you know, more than 500% since 1980. But there's also the fact that a number of people from that time period are still in prison. I had already mentioned John Clouchet, who was a co-defendant in the Soledad Brothers case. Rochelle McGee also had a very central role within this case, as you'll see when you buy and read the book. And a number of other people, right, who were involved in the movements on the inside in that time, right, who remain incarcerated alongside millions more who have since joined them. And we can talk more about who some of these people are in the Q&A. The last thing that I want to say, and this is just, I think, a really great photo of a recent demonstration, the Chowchilla Freedom Rally, is that prisons are an example of bad intersectionality, right? They're an example of the ways that state violence or oppression or whatever you want to call it targets the most marginal populations, right? By race, class, and gender, sexuality, right? Geography, citizenship status, HIV status, right? When we look at who's in prison, right? Who's affected by prison, we see the most marginalized, the most oppressed members of society, right? Who's connected to prison, right? Not just incarcerated, but the family members, right? The people who work to maintain community and social ties, right, despite the absence of loved ones, right? It's a clear example of how the system brings all that together, right? And so our movements, right, the opposition to prisons needs to be examples of good intersectionality, right? They need to be spaces in which people, right, across race and gender and sexuality and HIV status and citizenship status can pursue transformative, liberatory forms of social justice. Thank you very much.
And that was Dan Berger speaking on a panel discussion about current and historical prison resistance. The panel took place in 2015 and featured 3 other speakers in addition to Dan Berger. The entire recording of the panel can be found at thefreedomarchives.org.
And the time is presently 5:39 p.m. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca.
Cooper Concordia, Concordia Communication Studies present Taking a Knee to Take a Stand, Resistance in Sports in the Age of Trump. A panel discussion featuring Dave Zirin, award-winning author and host of the Edge of Sports podcast, Shireen Ahmed, the woman behind the Tales of a Hijabi Footballer blog, and the Sexual Assault Resource Center at Concordia. NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick's now-famous refusal to stand for the U.S. national anthem has sparked a watershed moment in sports, both on and off the field. But what will Donald Trump's rise to power and his dismissal of his sexual assault as locker room talk mean for activism in sports? Come find out at this all-star panel, Friday, February 17th, 6:30 p.m. at Concordia University, 1455 de Maisonneuve West, room H110. This event is wheelchair accessible, free, and open to the public. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
And next up, we have two short pieces by Asada Shakur. The first piece features Asada reading one of her poems entitled Carry It On. And the second piece is Asada's message to her supporters after her escape to Cuba in 1980. For those who are unfamiliar with Asada Shakur, Asada is a former member of the Black Panther Party and Black Liberation Army who was convicted of murder in 1977. Asada escaped from prison in 1979 and has been living in Cuba since 1984, where she has received political asylum.
Carry it on now. Carry it on. Carry it on now. Carry it on. Carry on the tradition. There were black people since the childhood of time who carried it on. In Ghana and Mali and Timbuktu, we carried on the tradition. We hid in the bush when the slave masters came, holding spears, and when the moment was ripe, leaped out and lanced the lifeblood of would-be masters. We carried it on. On hurling ourselves into oceans, slitting the throats of our captors, we took their whips and their ships. Blood flowed in the Atlantic, and it wasn't all ours. We carried it on. In sit-ins and pray-ins and march-ins and die-ins, we carried it on. On cold Missouri midnights, pitting shotguns against lynch mobs, on burning Brooklyn streets, pitting rocks against rifles, we carried it on. Against water hoses and bulldogs, against nightsticks and bullets, against tanks and tear gas, needles and nooses, bombs and birth control, we carried it on. In Selma and San Juan, Mozambique, Mississippi, in Brazil and in Boston, we carried it on. Through the lies and the sellouts, the mistakes and the madness, through pain and hunger and frustration, we carried on the tradition, carried a strong tradition, carried a proud tradition, carried a black tradition, carried on. Pass it down to the children, pass it down. Carry it on now. Carry it on. Carry it on now to freedom.
Uhuru, sisters and brothers. The first thing I want to say is that I love you. And the second thing I want to say is that we can win. We will win our liberation. And in order to win our liberation, we have got to think positively. We have got to believe that we can win. And if we don't believe that we can win, we're whipped before we start. We've got to realize what dangers exist, and we've got to look at those dangers realistically. We can't afford to have a subjective, distorted, irrational fear. We've got to look at the obstacles to our liberation coolly and clearly, and to develop ways to get rid of those, for us to struggle, for us to fight for our liberation and for our nation.
Black Panthers, in the spirit of Asada Shakur, we make this movement towards freedom for all those who have been oppressed and all those in the struggle. Yeah, yeah, check it. There were lights and sirens, gunshots fine, cover your eyes as I describe a scene so violent, seemed like a bad dream. She laid in the blood puddle, blood bubbled in her chest, cold air brushed against open flesh, no room to rest. Pain consumed each breath, shot twice with her hands up. Police questioned, but shot before she answered. One panther lost his life, the other ran for his. Scandalous the police were as they kicked and beat her. Comprehension, she was beyond, trying to hold on to life. She thought she lived with no arm, that's what it felt like. Got to the hospital, eyes held tight. They moved the room to room, she could tell by the light. Handcuffed tight to the bed, through her skin they bit. With guns to her head, every word she got hit. Who shot the trooper, they asked her. Put the mace in her eyes, threatened to blast her. Her mind raced till things got still. Opened her eyes, realized she's next to her best friend who got killed. She got chills if they told her that's what she would be next. Hurt mixed with anger, survival was a reflex. They lied and denied visits from a lawyer. But she was building as they tried to destroy her. If it wasn't for this German nurse, they would have served the worst. I read the sister's story, knew that it deserved a verse. I wonder what would happen if that would have been me. All of this just so we could be free, so dig it, y'all. Awakened up, walkie-talkies crackling, not saying where they taking her. Though she kinda knew what made the ride peaceful was the trees and the sky was blue. Arrived to Middlesex prison about 6 in the morning. Uneasy as they pushed her to the second floor in a cell. One cot, no window facing hell. Put in the basement of a prison with all males and the smell of misery. Seedless toilets and centipedes. She exercised, paint, and began to read. 2 years in the hole, her soul grew weak. Away from people so long she forgot how to speak. She discovered freedom is an unspoken sound. And a wall is a wall and can be broken down. Found peace in the Panthers she went on trial with. One of the brothers she had a child with, the foulness they would feed her, hoping she'd lose her seed. Held tight knowing the fight would live through the sea. In need of a doctor, from her stomach she'd bleed. Out of this situation a girl was deceived, separated from her, left to mother the revolution and lactate to attack hate. Cause federal estate was built for a black fate. Her emptiness was filled with beatings and court dates. They fabricated cases hoping one would stick. It says she robbed places that didn't exist. In the midst of threats on her life and being caged with Aryan whites, through dark halls of hate, she carried the light. I wonder what would happen if that would have been me. All of this just so we could be free. Yeah, I often wonder what would happen if that would have been me. All of this just so we could be free. So dig it, people. Her grandmother would bring news that she had had a dream. Her dreams always meant what they needed
victim to mean. What made them real was the action in between. She dreamt that Asada was free in their own house in Queens. The fact that they always came true was the thing. Asada had been convicted of a murder she couldn't have done. Medical evidence shown she couldn't have shot the gun. It's time for her to see the sun from the other side. Time for a daughter to be by her mother's side. Time for this beautiful woman to become soft again. Time for her to breathe and not be told how or when. She untangled the chains and escaped the pain. How she broke out of prison, I could never explain. And even to this day, they try to get to her, but she's free with political asylum in Cuba. About what it is, because I've never been free. I can only share my vision with you of the future, about what freedom is. The way I see it, freedom is the right to grow, it's the right to blossom. Freedom is the right to be yourself, to be who you are, to be who you want to be.
Hello, and we are back here on the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. And on the line, we have a member from the collective Détention et Politique. Welcome to the show. Hello, are you there?
Hello?
Hello. Okay, so we can hear you now. Can you tell us a little bit about the collective, Détention et Politique? Who are you and what do you do?
Yes, we are a group of persons that support people that were incarcerated. And we formed a year ago, approximately, and we organize a lot against austerity in the prisons and against the moving from women from Leclerc to, from Tanguy to Leclerc prison in Laval. So it's what we did during 1 year, and now we're starting new projects for this year.
Great. So
about against prisons.
Mm-hmm. And one of your projects this year, there's one coming up. There's a fundraiser taking place on Thursday, February 16th at La Defel. Can you tell us a bit about the fundraiser?
Yeah, it's a screening of the documentary 13th. It's about the prison situation in the United States and about the slavery that is still going on and racism in the prison in the States. And so, yeah, and it's for a fundraising for an event that is coming in March to bring two Black Panthers that were incarcerated for 40 years in the States. And they are coming to talk about it in Montreal in March. So we are trying to do a fundraising to bring money to pay the planes and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And so two of these members, they're members of the Angola Three. They comprise Albert Woodfox, Herman Wallace, and Robert King. Can you tell us a bit about the Angola Three and why you think it's important for two of the remaining members to come to Montreal in March?
In fact, the they just one of them just get out of jail last year, and they spend most of the time there in solitary confinement. So now they are trying to talk about it and to try to like make it illegal to put people in solitary confinement, because it's really intense, and it's also political. They like try to put people that are more taking more place and organizing in the prison to put them away from the groups. So, and it's really inhuman to put people in solitary confinement. So yeah, and we, coming here, it's also important because there is a collective, I don't know the name in English, but there is a group that is doing a pursuit against the prison judiciary system in Canada to against solitary confinement too. So it's really interesting to see, to have them coming here, talk about it in support of this struggle here in Canada.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us a little bit more about the details of the fundraiser, maybe what time it starts and what people can expect, like the déroulement? Yeah.
There is a potluck at 6, so people can bring food or just come and eat food with us. So we'll have a little time to talk, and we will start the screening at 7 p.m. And after that, if people are willing, we'll talk a little bit about the movie. And yeah, La Défelle is a nice place to sit, so we have the place for the evening and the night.
Mm-hmm. And so La Défelle is located at 1407 Rue Valois. And where can people find out more information about the group Tête Détention et Politique, and or where can they donate money if they're not able to come to the event on Thursday, February 16th?
We have a WordPress. It's called toutedetentionpolitique.wordpress.com. And they can also send us email at toutedetentionpolitique@riseup.net. And yeah, there is info, more info. There is a Facebook event. They can find it on Facebook for the screening. And if they want to donate, they can just send us an email.
Great. Thank you for your time. Did you have any final thoughts or comments you would like to share with our listeners today?
No, it's good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Have a good night.
You too. And so that was a member of the collective Toutes Détentions et Politiques talking about the fundraiser again taking place at La Défelle Thursday, February 16th. And so you have been listening to the Prison Radio Show here on CKUT, 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and CKUT.ca online. You can check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Prison Radio Show.
Prison Radio Show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday at 11 a.m. The next Prison Radio Show will air on Friday, February 24th at 11 a.m. If you have any questions on anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, feel free to contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you're in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. Feel free to write us at The Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, postal code H3A2B3. Thanks for tuning into The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Noah.
And my name is Candace.
And we've been your hosts for today. Please stay tuned.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is there is this thing?
Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
Do you realize our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news, brought to you live.